Picture this. The sun isn't up yet. You're 20 years old. You've been awake since 0400. Had something that passes for breakfast in the ship's galley. And now you're sitting in the cockpit of a Grumman Avenger on the flight deck of a light carrier in the Western Pacific. The ocean is flat and black in the pre-dawn. The engine is already warm, and you can smell the exhaust mixing with the salt air and the catapult gear grease. And somewhere out there through the dark is a chunk of Japanese-held rock called Chichijima, and it has more anti-aircraft guns than you want to think about right now. It is September 2nd, 1944. I'm Taildragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about a young Navy pilot, an airplane that changed the Pacific War, and a rescue that almost didn't happen. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, commercial, ATP all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. Now let's talk about the Grumman Avenger. To understand why the Avenger mattered, you have to understand what it replaced. The Douglas Devastator, the Navy's standard torpedo bomber. By the time Pearl Harbor was burning, the Devastator was already behind the curve. It had been cutting edge in 1935, a modern monoplane in an era of fabric biplanes, with retractable landing gear and an enclosed cockpit. But aviation moved at a sprint through the late 1930s, and the Devastator didn't keep up. Midway proved it. June 4, 1942, three American torpedo bomber squadrons launched from the carriers Enterprise, Hornet, and Yorktown, 41 Devastators. The results were catastrophic. Japanese Zero fighters tore through the low-altitude formations. Nearly every Mark 13 torpedo that was released either ran too deep, ran too slow, or failed to arm. The aircrews pressed home their attacks anyway, straight and level at wavetop height, flying through everything the Japanese could throw at them. Most of them didn't come back. It was one of the most heartbreaking episodes in American naval aviation history. Not because the men failed, they didn't. They showed a kind of courage that is genuinely difficult to comprehend from the outside. The airplane failed them. Here's where the story turns. While those squadrons were dying over Midway Lagoon, six brand new airplanes from Torpedo Squadron 8's shore detachment were already flying out of Midway Island itself. They weren't Devastators, they were Grumman's answer to the problem. The Avenger. All six of those Avengers were shot down in that same battle. Only one pilot survived the water. An ensign named George Gay, who spent the day floating in the lagoon with his life raft held over his head to hide from Japanese ships, watching the entire Battle of Midway play out above him. He described it later as the strangest afternoon of his life, but the Avenger survived as an aircraft, and Grumman was building more of them as fast as the ironworks could run. The Grumman Avenger was enormous, I mean genuinely, shockingly large for a single-engine aircraft, wingspan of 54 feet, 2 inches empty weight, right around 10,000 pounds, fully loaded for a torpedo mission. You were pushing 17,000 pounds off that deck with a single power plant. That is not a small ask of any engine. The power plant was the Wright R2600 Cyclone, 14 cylinders arranged in two rows, producing around 1,700 horsepower, enough to push that whole package to around 265 miles an hour at altitude, which was respectable for an aircraft of that size and weight. It wasn't going to outrun a Zero in a turning fight, but for what it was built to do, it was exactly right. Three crew members, pilot up front behind a large canopy with a good view of the target approach, behind the wing, a powered dorsal turret with a 50 caliber machine gun, down in the belly, a tunnel where the radioman doubled as bombardier on attack runs. The guy in the tunnel had a view that was mostly floor and fuel lines and the steady vibration of that big right up ahead. Communication was a mix of interphone, shouted words and hand signals through the plexiglass.
The internal weapons bay was one of the things that impressed people the first time they saw it open. Wide hydraulic doors, a cavity big enough to hold one Mark 13 aerial torpedo or up to 2,000 pounds of bombs. Later in the war, Avengers were fitted with rockets and radar for anti-submarine patrol. The design adapted, Grumman tends to build things that way. General Motors eventually took over much of production at its Eastern Aircraft Division plants on the East Coast. Those GM-built aircraft carried a slightly different type designation than the original Grumman machines. But pilots called them all Avengers regardless and didn't much care about the paperwork. By the time the war ended, close to 10,000 had been built. That is a staggering number when you think about what each one represented. Now, our pilot, George Herbert Walker Bush, was born June 12, 1924 in Milton, Massachusetts, and grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut. He attended the Phillips Academy at Andover, the kind of upbringing that in 1941 could very plausibly have led to a comfortable staff position or a desk commission arranged through family connections. His father, Prescott Bush, was a prominent figure in finance and would later become a senator from Connecticut. None of that mattered when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. George Bush was 17 years old. He had just been accepted to Yale. He enlisted anyway. He went through naval aviation pre-flight training, then primary, then advanced. He qualified on carriers, which is its own education. If you have never watched carrier operations from the flight deck, you cannot fully appreciate what it means to take off and land on a ship that is pitching and rolling in open ocean. It is not like any other flying. The deck moves toward you on landing approach. The catapult shoves you from zero to flying speed in about 2 seconds. The arresting wire stops you in the length of a tennis court. Everything about it is abbreviated and violent and demands precision. On June 9, 1943, 3 days before his 19th birthday, George Herbert Walker Bush received his naval aviator wings. He was 18 years old. Some sources identify him as the youngest naval aviator in the United States Navy at that time. The records from the era are incomplete enough that you can't state it with absolute certainty. But he was unquestionably one of the youngest. 18 years old, wings on his chest. The Navy assigned him to Torpedo Squadron 51 and eventually to the USS San Jacinto, an Independence-class light carrier. These were not the famous big fleet carriers. The Independence-class ships had been converted from Cleveland-class cruiser hulls, stripped down and given a flight deck. Fast, useful, and constantly in motion with the fast carrier task forces that were pushing across the Central Pacific in 1944. By the summer of that year, American forces had cracked through Japan's outer defensive perimeter. The Battle of the Philippine Sea in June, the one the Navy pilots called the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot, had effectively ended Japanese carrier aviation as a major threat. But that didn't mean the war was over or that the remaining targets were easy. Bush named his Avenger Barbara, after Barbara Pierce, the young woman he had met at a Christmas dance in Greenwich, Connecticut in 1941. They had been exchanging letters across the Pacific for over a year. Her name went on the nose of the airplane, in painted letters just forward of that big right cowling. Pull up a chair, because here's where the story gets personal. Chichijima, one of the Bonin Islands, which the Japanese call the Ogasawara Islands. The island had been under Japanese control since the late 19th century, and by 1944 it had a substantial military garrison, a harbor, and a communications complex that tied into the entire Japanese Pacific Command network. Radio equipment, direction-finding arrays, command and control infrastructure that coordinated defensive operations across a wide area of the Western Pacific. Hit those facilities and you degrade something important. The island was defended accordingly, layered anti-aircraft positions. Veteran gunners who had been sitting in those positions long enough to know exactly how American strike aircraft approached from the sea. On September 2, 1944, Bush launched with three other Avengers in a four-plane strike against the Chichijima radio installation. He was leading the flight. The attack profile required a low-level approach, threading through the island's terrain to hit the target from the right angle, which meant flying at close range below the ridgelines before pulling up and releasing. The Japanese gunners had seen this approach before. Bush's Avenger took hits on the inbound leg. The engine caught fire. Smoke rolled into the cockpit, that sharp, acrid smell of burning electrical insulation and hot metal that tells you the situation is getting bad faster than you'd like. His two crewmen were behind him, Lieutenant Junior Grade William White in the dorsal turret. Radioman Second Class John Delaney in the tunnel below. Bush made his call. He pressed the attack. He flew through the flak, completed his bomb run, released his ordnance on target, and pulled away from the island with the engine still burning. He called for his crew to bail out. He rolled the aircraft to make the egress easier. Then he went out himself. His parachute opened. Partly. He hit the water hard, disoriented, bleeding from a head wound. Swallowing Pacific seawater, he got the small inflatable raft deployed from his seat pack and looked around. The island was closer than he wanted it to be. He could already see boats leaving the shore, moving toward his position. He started paddling, away from the island, out to open water. He was strafed twice by Japanese aircraft that made low passes at him and didn't finish the job. He kept paddling. For 4 hours he floated in the Western Pacific, alone, sick, bleeding, a very long way from Greenwich, Connecticut. His two crewmen, White and Delaney, did not make it. The exact circumstances have never been fully established. George Bush spoke about them for the rest of his life, with a grief that never fully faded. He wondered, the way only survivors wonder, whether different decisions might have brought them home. People who have studied that mission carefully say he did everything right. That tends to be cold comfort. It usually is. Now, I need to say something about Chichijima, because the story is darker than most histories acknowledge. Other American airmen were shot down over or near the island during the war. 9 of them were captured by the Japanese garrison. General Yoshio Tachibana commanded the island's forces, and what happened to those prisoners was the subject of war crimes trials after Japan's surrender. I'll leave the details where they belong, in the historical record, and in James Bradley's thorough account in his book Flyboys. But the point stands, when Bush's parachute put him in the water west of the island rather than on the island itself, he was not simply lucky in a general sense. He was lucky in a very specific, very consequential sense. The water versus the beach, that gap was enormous. A periscope broke the surface. The USS Finback, a Gato-class submarine assigned to lifeguard duty during the Chichi-jima strikes, positioned offshore specifically to recover downed aircrew. She had been watching. She surfaced. Her crew came out on the deck with lines and pulled Bush aboard. By the fall of 1944, the Navy had a well-organized system for exactly this. Submarines assigned to loiter offshore during major strike operations, their purpose being to recover the men whose aircraft didn't make it back to the carrier. The program saved close to 500 aircrew members over the course of the Pacific War. 500 men, each one of them rescued by a submarine crew that surfaced into hostile airspace and open ocean and did the job anyway. A surface submarine is vulnerable. Enemy aircraft, enemy patrol craft, shallow water near the islands. The Finback's crew understood all of that and surfaced anyway. That is the submarine service's character, and it deserves to be said plainly. Bush remained aboard Finback for about a month, while the boat completed her patrol. When they finally put into port, the Navy offered him a rotation home. He had been through enough to justify it. He turned it down and returned to the San Jacinto. He flew 23 more combat missions before the war ended. 58 total, Distinguished Flying Cross, 3 air medals. He was 21 years old when it was over. 44 years later, he raised his right hand and took the oath of office as the 41st President of the United States. And every time he talked about flying in his later years, which was often, there was something in his voice that wasn't quite nostalgia. It was something closer to reverence. He knew exactly what that airplane had cost, and exactly what it had given him. The Grumman Avenger flew on long after the war. Surplus aircraft sold for a fraction of their production cost. Many of them ended up in Canada, flying maritime patrol and firebombing operations in the north, dropping retardant on forest fires over terrain that would have made the original design team raise an eyebrow. Some went into agricultural use. A handful are still airworthy today, flying at air shows and living in the collections of people who understand what those airframes represent. If you get a chance to stand next to one, do it. Stand under the wing and look up at the belly. Think about the tunnel where John Delaney sat. Think about what it meant to build 10,000 of those aircraft in 4 years, and what it meant to be 20 years old and fly one toward an island full of anti-aircraft guns. Because that was the mission, and you were the lead, and somebody had to go first. The sources for today's segment include George Bush's memoir Looking Forward, James Bradley's Flyboys, and the Naval History and Heritage Command's records on Torpedo Squadron 51 and the Pacific Submarine Lifeguard Program. Find us at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. September 2nd. Remember it.